everybody. It's Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, a guest or two to help you lead a more positively minded life. I've been looking forward to today, because today we're going to be talking about emotional fitness. We're going to be talking about emotional stamina. We're going to be talking about identifying your feelings. You know, how do you work with your feelings? How do you experience your feelings? How do you even know what you feel? These are the things we're going to be addressing today. Special guest, associate of mine, Dr. Vivian Wolsk, clinical psychologist, been doing this for a good period of time. Vivian, welcome to WBAI.
Well,
nice to have you
I'm
here.
I'm glad to be here. It's really a treat to meet you and be with you.
Yeah, exciting stuff. Let's punch these over here. Let's just get this around. There are so many people who try to deal with emotions in so many different ways. And the worst part about it is being able to feel your emotions or even make peace with your feelings. I want to start off with a concept of yours. What is emotional fitness? Let's go there.
Okay, I'm glad you asked me about that. I have a really clear idea that we make emotional problems into illnesses in our world much more than we need to, that there are people who are actually ill emotionally and they need medicine and they need hospitalization and so on. But most of us are just emotionally out of shape. Most of us just don't know how to use our emotions very well. We don't know what they are. We don't know how to express them. We can't tolerate very much of them. So our emotional muscles are in very bad shape. I talk about emotional flab that we've all got, and that we just don't bother to really work on that part of ourselves the way we do other parts of ourselves.
What are the signs of being emotionally flabby?
Anxiety. You go around feeling anxious a lot. You're feeling depressed a lot. You're worrying about everything all the time. You're fatigued. You know, everything seems to just tire you out. You get emotionally tired just like you get physically tired. You know, it's too much. Somebody starts talking to you in a confronting way and you just can't take it. You have to leave. You know, somebody wants to have a good debate with you. You feel like it's too much for you. You find yourself going into tears too easily or into anger very easily. Then you've got a short fuse. You've got a low tolerance for dealing with your emotions and other people's emotions. It's not just your own. It's other people's as well.
Ideally, we shouldn't be that reactive.
It's not about not being reactive. It's more you need to have a power in your reaction, a sense of grounding, a sense of your own force and ability to handle a situation.
Give me an example with that. People get, we're talking about people get very nervous and very anxious about things or very frightened.
Right.
And I think you're saying that when a person is frightened or jittery or they're just not in touch with what they feel, but they feel a vague sense of discomfort,
right,
that's emotional flabbiness.
Part of emotional flabbiness is the lack of awareness that you're talking about a lot, that you don't know what it is you're feeling. So you can't address it. You can't take care of the problem. If you don't know you're hungry, you can't eat. You know, if you don't know you're thirsty, you don't know to go drink something. So part of emotional fitness is knowing what your feelings are so you can do the appropriate thing to take care of what needs
now,
to be taken care of.
Now, most people think they know what they feel.
Well,
They'll say things like, I feel like working. I feel
right.
Like I feel tired. How do you know what's a real feeling from what's not a real feeling?
Right. A lot of people misname feelings and they're really talking about thoughts. They're not really talking about feelings at all. And that's a common thing people will say, that's not really a feeling. That's a thought. I feel like the world is coming to an end is not a feeling. That's a thought. What do you feel? What's going on in your body? The first thing we do in Gestalt, and we're very body-focused and body-respectful in Gestalt, and we realize that the body has wisdom, has knowledge to give us. And if you tune into what's happening in your body, you will get a much clearer sense of what your emotion is. So it's tune in. What you're feeling upset, you're feeling uncomfortable. What's going on in your body right now? And if you tune into that, oh, my heart's beating fast, you know, I feel an uneasiness in my stomach. All of those feelings start getting you closer to what it is that's going on for you. So that's the first step, is getting in touch with what's going on in your body.
I want to explain to people, when you say in Gestalt, we don't mean in Long Island.
Right.
It's not a town in Long Island. You
right.
know Gestalt, Long Island?
Okay.
It's on the North Shore.
Right. Gestalt therapy is the orientation
what,
I come
what
from.
What is Gestalt therapy?
Gestalt therapy is a very holistic kind of psychotherapy that includes and integrates the mind, the body, the emotions, and the spirit. We often talk about integrating it with the spirit as well, whatever that means to each of us. But Gestalt came out of a kind of a reaction against the very cognitive, intellectual analysis of the early 1900s. And it grew into, it started developing in the 30s and in the 40s, to have more respect for the emotions, for the emotional state, and for the actual relationship between therapist and client. Therapists were not anymore in Gestalt. They face their clients. They don't have them lying down on the couch looking the other direction. So as soon as you face your client, you see their body. You see their facial expression. You see their body language. You see all those kinds of things about them that lying on the couch were not even a part of therapy. So that was a very important part of Gestalt, was inclusion of the whole body in the psychotherapy process.
Inclusion of the whole is the very meaning of the word Gestalt, isn't it?
Yes.
So when people say we're looking at the Gestalt, we're taking in the entire thing.
Right, and that the whole is more than and different from each of the parts and a summation of the parts. It's another entity. So Gestalt has... really takes in all parts of the human being, the whole experience of the human being. But they're also talking about how does the individual relate to another individual? How does the individual relate to his environment? We have a lot of respect for environmental issues as well, not just the issues of the what's going on within an individual, but how they react to other people, what kind of relationships they have, what kind of a situation they're living in. The Gestalt and its ground. We have the ground and the Gestalt, so which are both very important.
How does this, so when you're looking at that, when a person is doing that in therapy,
right?
That's in therapy, but I mean people, do people Gestalt themselves?
Well, it's just really a way of thinking about people. We don't really talk about Gestalting yourself or Gestalting anybody else. We just
auto-Gestalt.
Right. It's really, Gestalt is really about being aware and being accepting of who you are in a totality. That's why I really looked forward to coming on your show, because so much of what you talk about is that kind of acceptance of the self, knowing who you are and then loving yourself, knowing yourself and being aware and loving. And I think that's so important, especially because so many of these shows on the radio are so negative and they're putting you down and they're criticizing, and you come from much more of a place of acceptance and love of the self.
Yeah, but and that's not the that doesn't make it the most popular show.
It doesn't make it so popular.
So that's an interesting thing.
Yes.
Why is the negative so popular?
Yes.
Why is the negative programming so possible?
Well, it's interesting you said negative programming, because I think that's what people have, is a lot of negative programming in them, in their minds, in their own minds as
so
well.
So you get a Dr. Ruth gets on the phone,
not
and you get...
Dr.
Ruth is
not negative. Dr.
Ruth
is okay.
She's kind of cute.
Dr. Laura.
Laura. I met Dr. Ruth the other day.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe
it. She's
it.
Very positive, actually.
Well, I know, but it was just like, it was amazing. It was like watching somebody come out of the movies, you know.
Yes.
It was like, oh, well, you're supposed to be on TV. You're not supposed to be. Met Joyce Brothers the other day was a different feeling.
Yes.
But Dr. Ruth, specifically. And Joyce Brothers has always been very positive with people, but the real negative ones, who are the most popular, Dr. Laura and a few other therapists
right.
are
and
on
some
the
of these TV shows that are all into negativity also bring a lot of people.
It seems that people yearn to have somebody be critical of them. They get on the air. Now, they'll even do this with Gary Null's nutrition show. They go on wanting to be scolded because they know that there's a part of them. They think they're going to finally get their controls by getting scolded. It's almost like they're going to injunct their parent. It's almost like, I'm going to make you yell at me, Mommy and Daddy, and then maybe I'll take control of myself.
Well, you were saying just the other day about how people are so dependent on their parents and keep them inside themselves.
Is that
the
how
negativity.
You see it?
And yeah, I see this
about?
As totally, they're still hanging on to the parent, as you said. They still feel like they need that negative parent with them. They feel not alone. They're not isolated when they have that negative parenting in there. But when you switch it and transform it into positive parenting, a whole new thing starts to happen. And I think that's really what I see as the process in Gestalt therapy and in the process that I call emotional fitness, which is tuning into the positive self-nurturing messages instead of all that negativity.
This is Armand DeMille. We're speaking with Dr. Vivian Wolfsk, Executive Director of the Gestalt Center for Psychotherapy and Training in New York. We're looking at emotional thing. Now, this is kind of interesting, Vivian, because if emotional fitness is the goal and emotional flabbiness is the general condition, is negativity and just being involved in negativity, would you consider that on the flabby part?
I think there has to be a balance in everything. And if you're, I don't think it's ever helpful to be badgering somebody and be putting them down and insulting them. I don't think anyone would say that's a good thing for anybody. As a parent, you certainly wouldn't do that to your child, at least you wouldn't do it and think you're doing good parenting. So to first realize that any kind of insulting and badgering and negativity that you say to yourself or to anyone else is not good. It's toxic. It's poison. It's like, you know, you don't eat things that are poisonous. You don't take in food that's going to hurt you. This is not good. It isn't good for people. And a lot of people have grown up in families where the way the kids were disciplined and where the way they got them to do things is by insulting them and putting them down and saying negative things. In sports, I mean, some of our great athletes got there because somebody was beating at them, and, you know, we almost glorify this kind of harsh discipline that's done to people. And it does work to some extent. It's not like it never works. You can get achievement, you know. I mean, the German army worked, you know, these things. They can get people to do things that way. But at what price to their psyche and to their sense of well-being and to a good world of loving people that take care of each other?
But on the other hand, you know, Vivian, and you remember the 70s, and the early 80s and the late 60s, there was a whole movement towards this other kind of hysteria, which is only the positive, don't touch any real feelings.
Right.
Let's dance on the surface.
Right.
Isn't there another condition of flabbiness, which is one that refuses to feel anything that's got
Absolutely.
Any depth at all?
Absolutely. You have to get in touch with your deep anger is important. To dump it on someone is a different issue. You can get in touch with rage that you feel at people who have done things to you in your life. Whether you should do it at them, that's another issue. What Gestalt has brought into therapy, and a lot of people have adopted this from, is we have these empty chairs and we have these pillows, and some people make fun of Gestalt with all the props that we use. But when you put somebody in that empty chair...
Well, wait, let's talk about it. You're assuming that people have even heard of it.
Okay.
But I think the empty chair technique is a fabulous technique,
yes.
And let's just give this a little background.
Okay.
I've been trained in Gestalt therapy myself. It was one of the things I learned and I found very valuable. The empty chair technique is a technique that people who are listening can use.
Absolutely.
Right now, you could use it in your own home. And in this technique, we have a background here. So let's talk about specifically what happens. If you were teaching a student, mm-hmm. one of your students, the empty chair technique, who has not read the book.
Right.
What would it be?
Well, I teach it to my clients. I don't even have to teach it to a student. A client comes in and they say, I've got this really terrible problem with my wife, and she, or my husband, or my mother, or whatever. And I say, okay, see if you can imagine them sitting over there in that chair over there, or in that couch over there. Or I bring a chair over and I say, and see if you can just picture your mother, your wife, your spouse sitting there, and say it directly to them instead of to me.
Okay, now before you do the and say it, mm-hmm. there's an important thing here. See if you can picture it.
Right.
Now, how do you picture somebody sitting in an empty chair?
Well, I'm very accepting of what anyone can get. If they can't see them sitting there, I say maybe you can just close your eyes and imagine them in a setting that you're familiar
with.
But
ideally what we're looking for is the person to physically see the person.
In
so
their
anybody,
mind.
Anybody listening right now,
right.
Wherever they are, they could look around and find an empty chair.
Right.
And then see somebody who you know sitting in that chair. Now,
right.
I would say start off with somebody who's not a parent. Try
right.
an easy one, right? Try seeing your roommate.
Right.
Can you see your roommate, whoever you live with, sitting in the uh-huh. chair somewhere in your empty room right now,
uh-huh.
where you are? If you're at work, see them opposite your desk sitting in a chair.
Right.
Can you take that time and just try to see them? And you'll right. see that as you look, even with your eyes open, you can actually visualize them in that chair.
Yes.
Fritz Perl said one-third of the people cannot visualize.
Okay. I don't
so
get into trouble with that.
You say it doesn't matter.
I don't think it really
even
matters.
Even if you imagine them with your eyes closed.
Absolutely. You can imagine them with your eyes closed. I have a very good student who can't visualize. She has a real problem visualizing at all. And she can still do the work. There's some way that she's imagining that person that isn't visual, whatever that means. A blind person doesn't know about visual. So they have a way that they can imagine somebody that maybe we can't even conceptualize what that is. But each of us has a way that we can think of someone, imagine them. The empty chair is just a vehicle to help. It's not a place to get stuck. Some people can't do it at all, and it doesn't matter. As long as you're helping them to set up a dialogue, whether it's internal or external, doesn't really matter. I have people visualize just sitting, you know, pretend you're in a setting somewhere with that person and see both of you, see yourself and see the other person.
So when we run into the problem cases, we can't use the chair, but two-thirds of the time at least, the person will be able to use that chair and visualize the person in the chair.
Very often
they
can.
Now, once they visualize the person sitting there, then they say what they would like to say, their inner feelings.
Yes.
Express them to the person in that chair.
Absolutely.
Well, a lot of people are going to say, why don't you just say it to the real person?
Well, because a lot of times it's not appropriate, and a lot of times it could get you into trouble. And a lot of times that person doesn't really deserve to be treated that way, even though you really have those feelings and you're entitled to them.
Even if you're saying, I love you. But no, but it's true. Sometimes they don't deserve to be treated
right.
that way.
I always leave the whether they're going to do it in the real world part of it for later. That's not a part of what the therapy process is. They'll know whether they should say it in the real world once they've done this kind of rehearsal, if you will.
I think there's an interesting thing about it, Vivian, because I think one of the reasons to do it with an empty chair technique is that there's a problem with the person's reaction.
Yes.
We don't want their reaction. We want this as a level of development for us, the protagonist, who's trying to learn about
absolutely.
Ourselves.
Absolutely.
We don't want to have that person reacting to us, because if they react, then they could take us off our own path. Because whatever it is I'm usually feeling, if it's intense, it's got a history. And through this technique of the empty chair, you can find your history.
Right.
How do you trace your history by doing this?
Well, it's interesting what you say, because very even with the empty chair, people start reacting as if it's a real person sitting
sure.
there.
Sure, sure.
And they'll say, well, oh, I can't say that, because now they're going to say thus and such. So I said, well, let's assume they say thus and such. Sometimes I have them then get into the other person's, into the chair, and they be the other person.
Okay,
that's
so let's slow that
process.
Down. I know that's easy for you to
right.
say, and again, familiar for people who are in the process. Another step of the empty chair technique is to get, once you say what you want to say to the person, you physically get up and sit in the very chair of the person who you are imagining.
Absolutely.
Then you make yourself be them, and you say, you respond back to you. And what you do when sitting in that second chair is you visualize yourself sitting in the first chair.
Okay.
Now, this is complicated. So we're talking about a thing called the empty chair technique. At first, you start imagining somebody sitting in a chair. Then after you say whatever you want to say to them, the therapist, like Vivian or someone else, will get you to get up, move in that chair, sit in that chair. The directions, as I remember them, were sit in that chair and sit in a posture that person would typically use.
Yes.
Imitate their body. Even use their facial expression. And then from that other point of view, look and see you sitting in the chair. Mm-hmm. This is the empty chair technique. This is the science of it.
Mm-hmm.
See, we could describe it lightly, but I think it's in the detail that's where the fine work takes place. And now you're sitting in this other chair, looking at you who just said something to you, like I get angry at you when you leave me bad letters in the morning, you know, before you leave, something like that. Now, that person's going to talk back to you, and they're going to say something that's going to come right from your mind.
Right.
So what happens at that point?
Well, the thing is, a lot of times the person who's doing the exercise will say, well, they're not going to hear me, you know, they're never going to listen to me, they're just going to shut me up, and then that usually would end their usual confrontation with this person.
Mm-hmm.
So then I say, okay, but here you can keep going. Keep going. Don't stop now. This person isn't really here. They're not really saying these things. What do you say back? This is a safe place where you can say anything you want. You can make, they'll say, oh, they're going to get up and leave. They're not going to stay and listen to me say this to them. I say, but in this room, you can stay. That you can have them stay. I am here, and we're keeping that person here, and you're going to say everything you need to say to that person. Just what you said before, in real life, we're interrupted all the time in our attempts to tell people what we want to tell them. We interrupt ourselves. An important part in Gestalt is looking how we interrupt ourselves all the time. So this is a big interruption.
Self is interruptus.
Yes.
A real
self-is
disorder.
Interruptus is a very big. So in what you're doing with empty chair and with any of these things is bypassing all the interruptions. You say, keep going. Okay, so they said that. So what do you say now? Okay, so they did this. So what do you do now? And keep it going and keep so that, as you say, it's an exercise for the person to get out everything they're feeling without it getting stopped or interrupted by the actual person who would do that. So they're getting a chance to really find out. And it usually leads into something else. Eventually, the person they're talking to in the chair becomes somebody else.
Now, what does that mean, the person in the chair becomes somebody else? You find that when you're expressing your emotions, it brings up emotions to you, and a therapist or somebody sitting there may say, well, that must sound familiar.
Right.
You say something like that, because that's what we're looking for in therapy.
That's right.
We're looking for the person to identify that if their feelings are very intense, there's an association to something in your childhood that's unresolved.
That's right.
And the way you get to that thing that's unresolved is by saying the very same words to one person, and then having someone on the background or in your own mind, or if I were doing it, since I'm trained, or you, Vivian, I'm sure that if you're doing it with yourself, you would say, where is this familiar to? Where does it connect to?
And the important thing in Gestalt is it doesn't just stay in your mind that way. It's then, okay, if this reminds you of the way your father used to talk to you, they've got this person in the chair, let's see if you could imagine your father there now. And what do you want to say to him? And so you're going back to the source. You're going back to the person who deserves the feelings that you're feeling, and you're then continuing this dialogue now at another level of what happened. And sometimes the person talking can start feeling like they're that little child again talking to their father. And often I'll say to a client, how old are you right now? Because you see right in front of you how they've transformed. They're not talking as an adult anymore.
Now that, again, you see, now you throw in another one of your brilliant methods. We're talking with Dr. Vivian Wolfe, who's one of the leading, if not the leading, Gestalt therapist in New York. And might be around the world, too. Because, Vivian, you've been doing this for a long period of time, director of the Gestalt Center for psychotherapy and training. Now here's a new technique. See, old hat to you because you do it so automatically. How old are you right now? A simple thing. Those of you listening, you're listening, right? You're listening to the radio. How old do you feel? Think if you were younger than you are. Imagine you were a child. How old do you feel right now? Now, this is a method that therapists use when they're talking to their clients, because the client is presenting themselves as this professional person, this grown-up person, but inside they feel little. So if you ask someone to stop and say, how old do you feel right now? They're going to pick an age. It could be 12, it could be 8, it could be 5. Usually some age, and you could usually tell because they're sitting in exactly the same position they sat then. Like, for example, right now, you, I'm sure, used to sit in school that very same way, with your hand maybe under your chin, your elbows on a desk. You know, it could be that. It could be you're listening and you got your head tilted to one side. It could be the way you've got your legs crossed, but it's the same way you did it when you were a kid. Once you identify the way you are with your body and where you are, you can actually be that age.
Absolutely. Now that becomes, that's so important.
And that becomes such a fruitful thing, Vivian.
Yes. Because one of the important things you do with empty chair work is to put parts of yourself in the other chair. So at that point, you could say, can you see yourself at that age? Let's say somebody says, I'm feeling six. Do you remember yourself at six? Do you have an image of yourself as a six-year-old? Could you see that little boy or that little girl over there in front of you? Could you visualize that person? And then it's having a relationship as the adult you are now with that part of yourself, with that vulnerable, injured, young part of yourself. And that's when very deep work happens in therapy. Absolutely.
You know, it's amazing when you think about it how different it is to do psychoanalysis when you lay on the couch and you talk up in the air and you got somebody in back of you who's saying, uh-huh. You know what I mean?
Right.
And eventually you get to a lot of important issues.
Absolutely.
By repeating, cathartic, by releasing all of that stuff.
It just delimits you to your head. It just doesn't take you someplace. Well, that's what Fritz Perls, who started this whole Gestalt stuff, was really his contribution, was that it's okay. It's important stuff. It's not like it's not the basis of everything we do still. Freud was very important. But it's really including all of this emotional stuff and interactive stuff and using the relationship between the therapist and the client as an index, as a way of healing. It's a healing relationship. It's not just somebody sitting.
And it's a lot faster. What I like about it is you can do a lot of it. You could learn it,
right,
and you could work on yourself. You could use these techniques on your own and
right,
learn
you
about yourself.
Do homework. Yourself. This is a homework kind of therapy. Absolutely.
It's not just waiting for the next session to come in.
No, there's got to be work done in between sessions. And I always tell people to get out photographs. This is something you might want to tell your audience. Take out a photograph of yourself as a child. Look for a photograph that really touches you, that brings up something for you, usually young, you know, 3, 4, 5, sometimes even younger. Take that photograph and put it in a frame and put it in a prominent place in your home and bring that part of you into your life again. Really have a relationship, like you are rediscovering that person and giving them the parenting they didn't have, giving them the love that they missed out on. It's very concrete, but our minds are that way, very concrete.
I found a 2-year-old photograph of me from when I was 2 years old,
yes,
which was one of those painted photographs. You know, before they had color photographs,
absolutely,
they used to paint
yes
them. I got it hanging in the kitchen here at the DeMille Center. Mm. It reminds me all the
every
time. Every time I walk by, I see that kid and say, hi there, kitty.
Yeah, and that's so important when you said the hi there, kitty.
Hi
that's
there,
what I
kitty
say. I tell them every day, look at the kid and say, hi, I love you. I love you, kid. You know,
yeah,
I'm here. I care about you. That reminds me of what I was telling you before about looking in the mirror.
Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We have a guest and good friend, Vivian Wolsk, Executive Director of the Gestalt Center for Psychotherapy and Training in New York, clinical psychologist, talking about people and their emotions and their feelings. We're going to get back
right
to that as soon as we get back from
right
our break. Listen, my friends, you must be tired, huh? Tired of trying to learn about things, trying to get things done, trying. It doesn't stop, but you know, it's... The more you try, somewhere along the line, you're going to get it. But my deep respect for you, for all of those who find this such a tedious, tedious task. I understand. I understand.
I'm so tired. I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired. My mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I get up and fix myself a drink? No, no, no.
Talk about the mirror. You know,
I wanted to talk about how the kinds of exercises people can do every day just on
sure
their own. They don't all have to, you know, I know you say this a lot too. Everybody doesn't have to be in therapy. therapy is helpful and gives you some grounding and some support to do this work, but there are a lot of things that everybody can just do on their own to keep their emotional fitness going. One of the things is I tell people, you know, we talked about the photograph, looking at a picture of yourself and saying really loving things. But the other thing is every day we look in the mirror, every one of us look in the mirror 100 times, you know, during our week and or several times during our day. And most of the time we say negative things to ourselves and we pick at ourselves and we criticize what we see there. So I ask my clients and I tell other my students to look in the mirror every day and say really loving, positive things like you would to your child as you send them off to school in the morning or your lover. This is your lover in the mirror. And you're saying, I love you. I care about you. You're the most important person in my life. All those things are true. And really say it like you mean it. And while you're looking in the mirror, take in that the person in the mirror is saying it to you. So it's a double whammy. You're not just giving it to that person in the mirror, you're simultaneously getting it back. Mm-hmm. So it's a very powerful experience. And if you kind of go shift, toggle back and forth between I'm giving it, I'm getting it, I'm giving it, I'm getting it, there's a lot of power in that.
We're speaking with Vivian Wolsk, talking about kissing the back of your hand, kissing your face in the mirror.
But, you know, I think words are important too, Harma.
Okay,
you know,
go
even,
with it, Vivian.
Even though you don't believe the words, and a lot of clients will say that, you know, well, how can I say that? I don't really believe it. If you had a little kid, you don't have to believe things you say to children. You comfort them. You say loving, comforting things. Even in a scary, dangerous situation, you say lovely things to your kids. You know that wonderful Italian movie, Life is Beautiful, where he's with mm-hmm. his little boy in the concentration camp, and he's not telling him the truth. He's just keeping that little kid feeling okay. He's keeping him feeling safe and loved. So you can do that with yourself, too. You can say to yourself in the mirror, even when you're feeling grouchy and when you think it's a terrible day, and even when you look at the face and you think he looks a little funny or, you know, old or she doesn't look as pretty as she used to, you don't say that to them. You say, you know what, I love you. And that's it. Just simple, even if you don't believe anything else. The I love you comes back from the mirror. And it really has a healing effect. No matter whether the person truly believes it or not, the words still work. And the more you say it, the more you start believing it. It's something that the more you do it, the more it becomes your reality. And if somebody every day tells you, you know, you're awful and they hate you, you start feeling that way. That doesn't mean it's true. You're not awful and you're not ugly. It's just that you start believing it because the voice in your head is saying it over and over and over. I really want people to change the voice in their head and really confront those negative
voices.
And
the words are important. You know,
the words
so many
are
people,
important.
Even the words that we use have to be changed because the programming is so filled with bad words.
Absolutely.
There are such harsh words. You know, it's a funny thing. As you're speaking, I see the look on your face. And I say to myself, you know, this is not just a theory. Vivian does this. She talks to the lady in the mirror, doesn't she?
Absolutely. I do. I do. I do talk to myself in the mirror.
What do you think about creativity? Do you think it's important that people are creative? Do you think it's important if people play the cello and piano?
I think creative outlets are wonderful. For you know, everyone needs to find the thing that gives them that kind of joy. I love music. I love to sing. I play the piano. Everyone's got to find something for themselves, whether it's writing or whether it's painting or whether it's just something that nobody else. I have a client who found origami, and she is in heaven with origami.
Mm-hmm.
She and knitting. Somebody else will knit. You know, it doesn't have to be something huge and mine, you know, changing the world in any way. It's just you doing something and seeing a product come out of it. Some people feel creative doing housework. Some people feel creative ironing and cleaning and at the end looking at this wonderful job they did. and, you know, or the guy who loves to putter around down in his workbench or, you know, out in the yard or, you know, everyone's got their little things they like to do, or even sports, you know, someone who loves to play tennis or.
Don't you also, I've heard you talk about, using even something like housework to be creative and to develop yourself emotionally. How do you do that?
It's so important to do these emotional exercises every day. So you want to find, everyone's too busy to say, I'm going to take time out now and do my emotional exercise. What else do I have to do now? I know I got to go to the gym. I got to do this. I got to do emotional exercises. So what I say is that there are 100 times every day that you can be doing these exercises while you're doing all the other things you do in your life, like the housework, like the riding on the subway, like in your car on your way to work, like when you're out jogging, or doing your physical exercise, or puttering around doing all, your mind is not busy during most of those activities. At least it doesn't have to be busy. Sometimes it is. It's busy, you know, saying negative things to yourself. So during those times when the mind is really in neutral, you can use it to be saying positive things to yourself, to be thinking positively about
yourself. Give me an example of that. So let's say you're vacuuming a rug.
Right.
Right.
One of the things, well, with housework, I think is great. There's a lot of imagery in housework that can go, can be used. Like, I'm cleaning up. I'm really getting rid of all the dirt in my life. I am really making my life orderly. I'm putting everything into place. And to keep saying those things over and over while you're doing it. You know, window washing is wonderful. You're looking out your window. It's got all that grime on it. Get yourself a rag and some spray and say, oh, I am making this window totally clean. I am clear now. I can see. Everything is becoming clear to me. The world is now, you know, available. Anything that's a positive kind of aphorism.
Like I'm taking out the garbage. That's perfect, right?
I am taking out the garbage, and I'm getting rid of all the garbage in my life, and I'm starting fresh, and I'm making room for new things in my life. And to say those positive things to yourself whenever you have the opportunity, as much as you can. Just like you would say, if you had a child, you would want to say loving, positive things to them as often as possible. And that's what we want to say to ourselves. And everything you're saying to yourself, you need to say to yourself, would I say this to someone I love? Would I be saying these words to someone I love? If you wouldn't be, stop it.
Yeah, it's amazing what people do say to each other in the name of
Absolutely.
Relationship. They're so harmful with each other. The words that you say. Sometimes I hear myself saying words that are harsh towards people.
Sure.
And I say, what's this coming out of my mouth? How could this be? I love this person. How could I be doing that?
Right. But you do need outlets for that, and I know you've said that a lot. What do we do with all those angry feelings? What do we do with all the hatred and the rage? There are places to work that out. You can go to the gym. You can go pound it out. You can take a big pillow and do whatever you need to it and say every name you want to it. You can release all those emotions in a safe place.
Our guest, Vivian Wolsk, who practices what she preaches. See, that's the thing. The thing is, you got to live it, you know? Now, you bring your own spirit into your own work, right? Vivian,
do
you love your work you do?
I love it,
yeah. Well, I got an idea. If we bring music into our lives, which I do my radio program and I play my music
on
the air, which I love to do. Occasionally, I'll be doing some of my drumming. You do it through singing, don't you?
Yeah.
Right?
I love to sing. I write songs, too. And I use all the stories, the wonderful stories that my clients come in with always give me wonderful I never run out of material to think of things to write my songs. They're not exactly the kind of songs people probably are going to get very popular because they're too intense and deep, but I love them. I love writing them, and I sing them, and my friends enjoy them. And
when you sing, what happens to you? When you sing something you really know, like let's say you sang something about, what is this? Springtime? Summer. Do you know Summertime?
Yes, it's one of my favorite songs.
If you sang Summertime, what feeling comes over to you when you sing Summertime? What changes in your gestalt as you sing?
For me, when I'm singing or when I'm doing something creative, I just feel very much at one with what I'm doing and where I am. And I'm totally just in the act of what I'm doing and what I'm singing and the words that I'm singing. And as much as you can stay whole in whatever you're doing, whether it's singing or sports or some other thing that you love to do, it's the totality of your being in that experience that I think is so healing. And that's why art is so healing to people.
But Vivian, you know, there are so many people who try to do their art from a disconnected part of themselves.
Yeah.
They don't find the center from which to sing or from which to dance. Mm-hmm. They find it from their legs as opposed to from...
I think you have to just keep doing it. I have a belief in the artistic and the creative in people. If you just stay with it,
would you do me a
you
favor?
Will find it.
Dr. Wolf, would
yes.
you do me a favor?
Mm-hmm.
Can I hear Summertime?
You want to hear Summertime?
I want to hear Summertime. Can you do it from that place? This is not expected,
he didn't tell
right?
me he was going to do this.
But listen, you're a therapist who sings.
Mm-hmm.
Let me hear what it's like when a therapist reaches into that place and brings up a sound. Would you do it for me?
Sure.
I'd love it.
Summertime. And the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high. Oh, your mammy's rich, and your dad is good looking. So hush, little baby, don't you cry. You want more? Nah.
Wow, you're a knockout.
Thank you.
You're a knockout. I want more. I want more. I know I've got a big, important radio show here to do. I want that next stanza. I'm done. Come on, give me one of these mornings, would you?
One of these mornings, you're gonna rise up singing. Then you'll spread your wings and you'll take to the sky. But till that morning, there ain't nothing can harm you. With Daddy and Mammy standing by.
How beautiful. Thank you so much. Look at you change. Look at you. You just melted.
Yeah, it does. Makes
you
me feel
great. You turned
into
butter. Yeah,
makes
I see.
Makes me feel great.
You see, now look. And it's perfect, too. Where do we find our daddy and mommy to be standing by in the summertime?
That's why I love the song.
Because we got to find it inside ourselves.
Absolutely.
What happens to us? We lose it. We keep waiting for daddy and mommy to be coming from the outside, and we learn that eventually it comes from the inside.
And you know what's interesting, Armand? You have the old mommy and daddy in there, and as you say, people are so afraid to let go of the old mommy and daddy. And before you can bring in the good one, there has to be that moment of emptiness. You know, that moment of not having the mommy and daddy, that feeling, that scary feeling. And that's what so many people have trouble with. So they just hang on to the old one.
So if you're filled with negativity, self-criticism, self-doubt, you know, self-contempt, as we called it yesterday, you're filled with it. It's part of this negative projected introject. Right? Negative critical interject, which means the very swallowing of the words and the person that went along with it. And when you are find yourself berating yourself, it is because you need your parent at the moment, and the only available one that you could find is the negative one. You know, okay. That's the only one that was there. Yesterday I got an email from someone who was a therapist who said, hey, this concept of the negative parental interdict, I hear you've got some citations for it. Where do you find out information about that as being the basis of all self-criticism? Of course it is. Well, Gestalt therapy would be a good place to look because it certainly talks about it. So does Freudian psychoanalysis. But the idea, I think you're saying something important. You look around for a mommy and daddy and you can't find it anywhere. I mean, not a real mommy and daddy, but we look around for being loved.
And we need it.
We all want to belong to something, you know? We want to belong to something. We want to feel connected to something. Kiss the mirror. You know what I mean? But then you look around for it. Where's my mommy? Where's my daddy? You can't find it, so you beat yourself up. So you become critical of yourself because that's the only way you can connect. And therein, you feel like a bad child.
And that loving face in the mirror that you start looking at can be the one you keep inside during the day and you think about and picture. That's my loving parent. That face I saw in the mirror today. Because it's always a little foreign. When I see my face, it looks a lot older than I think I am. It's a parent face in that mirror. That's what I'm looking at, and that's the one I try to keep inside.
So when you have to get rid of this programming of this negative interject, this self-criticism, there's going to be a period that's going to feel like dying.
Absolutely. That's your annihilation thing that you talk about.
You go through. Okay. You go through a period where you actually start separating with the negativity in your life. And it feels terrible.
Right.
Because negativity, believe it or not, they're like nails. You know, they may be nails in your coffin, but they're like nails. They pin you down. They hold you down. They keep you on the ground. At least some people identify themselves and feel real through their negativity.
Right.
When they remove those nails, they're floating in air.
Absolutely.
And they don't know what that feels
that
like.
That floating, we call that impasse in Gestalt. That's a very
talk
important
about that. What is impasse?
Impasse is that moment where you can't do what you used to do anymore, and you don't know how to do something new yet. You're in that in-between place. You know, we use images like on the trapeze where you're jumping and you're hanging on to one trapeze and then you have to let go at one moment when you jump to the other one. It's that moment of the letting go, that moment when you're not sure you're going to catch the other one. You're not sure what's going to happen to you because you're so used to this old way of being, even though it's never doesn't work and you're feeling awful. You're at a point where you have to give up the old way, but you don't know a new way yet. You haven't learned it yet. It doesn't feel like you yet.
And there's a nervous period of time.
Very nervous.
And it's a nervous period of time.
And
that's all it is.
You have to be patient with yourself.
Well, you see,
that.
I think you have to be patient with the nervousness because people,
that's
I think, hate anxiety almost more than anything.
Right. And just breathe. I know right. During those times you have to sit and breathe and comfort yourself and calm yourself and say, this will pass. I will get through this.
Very often I've seen new clients come in, patients who are coming in, and they ask me what they could expect, especially when they're depressed. I'll say, there's going to be a period of time when your depression lifts and you're going to start feeling nervous. You have to welcome that nervousness as a sign of life. It's going to feel like you've taken too much niacin. You know, you're going to feel yourself buzzy.
Right.
And that's going to be part of life coming back to you. But people become intolerant of anxiety.
Like pins and needles. When
yes,
you're, you know?
Exactly. And so what people do is they become intolerant and they'd rather be depressed than be anxious. But anxiety very often is the coming back to life.
Absolutely.
It's the losing of the old stuff and the beginning of opening the door to the new stuff. Mm-hmm. Not easy. Let's take a couple more concepts of Gestalt therapy and just teach them to people. One that I like that I know we didn't talk about, let's talk about confluence and what that means. I think that that's really one of Fritz's major contributions.
Right. You mean where two people
exactly.
Think, well, you think that you don't know where the difference is between you and the other person. It's interesting because there's been a lot of writing and talk about that, that there can be positive confluence as well as negative confluence. There are moments.
Let's talk about what it is first.
Okay. It's kind of that ego-less state, that state of not knowing the difference between you and someone else.
Now you very often
feeling the oneness with another person.
You very often see this with people who join their names. Sometimes they join the names.
Mm-hmm.
The name is Robert and the other person's name is Anita, so he says, we're Ronita.
Right.
And they combine their names, right. And you start to see that the two of them have become one,
right.
And almost like they lose their separate selves completely.
Right.
Now, this some people think of as ideal.
In a moment, it can be a wonderful feeling. It's a lot, people seek that in religion and when they're feeling at one with the universe and there are moments in sexuality that are that sense of losing who you are and just oneness. Those are wonderful feelings, but they're only for the moment. They're not a way to live your whole life. And
what's the danger of confluence?
Well, the danger is that you just aren't being who you are, and you're really lost. You've lost the person that you are. At some point, it's interesting. I think people who are prone to confluence, if we were really going to look into what the dangers are, they're the ones who get all the physical illnesses. You know, you've talked about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
They have to express, the human nature is to express who it is. It has to do it somewhere. And if you're not letting it be in the realm of the identity of who you are and what you feel and your history is going to come out somewhere.
That's an interesting concept because in the Enneagram, which we've been talking about on the air, the two, which is the giver, the one who gives, you know, always giving,
mm-hmm.
they tend to become confluent with their mates.
That's right.
They now completely don't identify with themselves anymore. They identify with their mates. They become part of the other person.
They're living through everybody else.
And they are most prone to getting ill.
That's right.
Right. The other one who does that is the nine, by the way, which is called the peacemaker, who tends to merge with such an intensity that they're just merging, that they're looking to merge. They're on the verge of merge their whole life. You know, verge of merge.
Well, when confluence is being used as a way to avoid your own feelings, that's where you know it's going to be a problem. And it becomes a hideout. You know, it becomes a place to hide out where you don't have to be yourself.
You see it a lot, especially in early development, around 16, 17 years old, children falling in love with either a symbol or a real person, and they're in love because they're escaping a lot of the anger that they feel.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get away from their feelings, so they merge.
Right.
So they're merged with this other person. They are one with this other person because they want to escape what they feel.
Right. And to some extent, that's healing if it's only in the moment. We all need our escapes, and we have to respect our need for escapes. But when it becomes an addiction, when it becomes a way of life, then you've got a serious problem.
If people wanted to read about Gestalt therapy, if they wanted to learn Gestalt therapy, what book do you recommend?
Well,
I've got mine, but
yeah, Fritz Perl's book Gestalt Therapy Verbatim is still available. It's a very, very nice book, and he also in there he talks about Gestalt, but he also has some actual dialogues of Gestalt sessions. But it's old, it's dated, it's not what we do in therapy so much today, but it's still a very wonderful book to read.
I like the one by Perls, Heffelein, and Goodman,
mm-hmm.
the original Gestalt
that's
therapy
book. That's a wonderful book, but that's a hard book to read.
It's a hard book to read. For those people who want to get a little more technical about
yes.
it, what's good about that book
has exercises
is the first
too.
Two chapters
yes.
that have the exercises, contacting the environment, contacting yes. the self. The book is out of print, but now reprinted.
Oh, it's been put back, and they reversed the sections. I think the exercises are in the back. No.
Oh, really?
And the other parts
thank
the
you.
Front.
I would have sent everybody to the front.
But in
they
any
also,
case,
they do a good job
the book
on confluence.
Is out. Yeah.
It's Gestalt Therapy, Gestalt, by Perls Heffelein, Hefferline.
There's also a lot of Gestalt information on the web for people who want to look it up.
Vivian, we want you back with us because there's other stuff I want to go into.
This is fun. I love it. Thanks.
I think I'm going to have you back just to sing. Doctor, imagine having a doctor who sings to you. Well, bad enough you have a doctor who plays drums for you, right? And imagine having a doctor who sings for you, walk in.
You're going to play, you bring your drums?
No,
I'll bring
I don't.
My piano and.
You know, maybe we'll do that here.
We'll jam a little.
Bring a conga drum, you'll bring your piano, we'll get a little bit
keyboard,
done here,
right?
And we'll see. Therapist on the air. Many years ago in the 70s, I remember having one thing where I had all the therapists, including Alana Rubenfeld and all the great therapists who were part of the Association for Humanistic Psychology, did one wonderful effort together. We had a job of getting getting 2,000 people to walk 2 miles in 100-degree weather. It's 102 degrees at Princeton. So we had to get them to walk, so we created a ceremony. And each of the therapists did something different. Alan Diane Pesso, who are these famous therapists, were up in a tree. They were, and everybody did their little thing. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful because you see the creativity of the therapist and the therapist getting a chance to show the playful side of them. Because therapy can't be that serious. It just can't be.
Hey, well, if you really tempt me, I'll come and bring one of my original songs.
Oh, we're going to have to do this. We'll have you back. It's Vivian Walsh, WLSK. This is Armand DeMille with you. It's A Positive Mind. We're talking about emotions. I hope you've learned as well as I have. We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends, because there are great therapists everywhere. Here's one of my favorite therapists.
Now somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day his woman ran off with another guy, hitting young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like that. He said, I'm gonna get that boy. So one day he walked into town, booked himself a room in the local saloon. Rocky Raccoon checked into his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. Rocky had come equipped with a gun to shoot off the legs of his rival. His rival, it seems, had broken his dreams by stealing the girl of his fancy. Her name was McGill, and she called herself Lil, but everyone knew her as Nancy. Now she and her man, who called himself Dan, were in the next room at the hoedown. A Rocky burst in and grinning a grin. He said, Danny boy, this is a showdown. He drew fast and shot, and Rocky collapsed in the corner. He said, Rocky, you met your match. And Rocky said, Doc, it's only a scratch. And I'll be better, Doc, as soon as I am able. And now Rocky Raccoon, he fell back in his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. Gideon checked out, and he left it no doubt.